Mr. Mayor, I'm officially appointing you as my civil deputy. It's now your job to make sure that civil services in this town carry on working smoothly. So you'll be doing essentially the same thing as before, but with some exceptions. We keep an eye on your work. The council is suspended for the duration. I'm not putting up with a herd of blabbermouths whining away to me night and day. Second, you can't resign. Third, in public, you will give me your full and utmost cooperation as an example to everyone else. Fourth, my second-in-command will now assume control of your police force. Laws will remain the same, with one principal addition. Interfering with our activities is a capital crime. And we're going to start with the little shit who just went and shot one of my men. Shot? Killed, actually. I take it you deny all knowledge. Miles looked round the suited figures, wishing desperately that he could see their faces. I didn't know that. I'll accept your avowal for now. But believe me when I say we'll find whatever resistance movement you people have cobbled together and exterminated. I will not tolerate interference with our operation, and certainly not at that level. Somebody shot one of you? Yes. And the platoon leader seems to think it was a deliberate trap. But wasn't your man in a skin suit? He was. That's what I really don't like about this. Jesus. Quite. Now, I take it you've heard about our good behavior collateral policy? The news about the death had made Miles' heart jump in panic. ZB hadn't been in Mimu Bay 30 minutes, and already their commander was being forced to consider reprisals. Now the mention of collateral made the muscles across his chest tighten up. I've heard. Of course you have. Every Zhang reached into one of the pouches on his belt and produced a loop of what looked like white plastic string. We are going to select 1,000 or so honest and true citizens of Memu Bay and put these necklaces on them. Each necklace contains a small discharge mechanism filled with nerve toxin. It's quite painless. After all, we are not savages. But it will kill the recipient within 5 seconds, and needless to say, there is no cure or antidote. Every mechanism has a specific number, and for every act of violence committed against Zanhue Braun, one or more of those numbers will be selected at random. They will be transmitted by our satellite. The mechanism will discharge, and the wearer will die. If anyone attempts to tamper with or remove their necklace, the mechanism will discharge. The mechanism also has an inbuilt 24-hour timer, which the satellites have to reset every day, again by broadcasting a code. So if anyone thinks he can escape by hiding away underground or in a shielded room, he will only be able to do so for 24 hours. Any questions? I think you've made yourself clear. Very well. Let us hope that it works, and we don't have a repeat of today's murder. The plastic was rubbed absently in his thick-skinned fingers. Miles couldn't shift his gaze away from the awful thing. Are you going to put that on me now? Good heavens, no, Mr. Mayor. What would be the point in that? They are supposed to guarantee good behavior on others. If your political opponents saw you'd been fitted with one, I imagine they'd go straight outside and start hitting my people over the head with rocks. You see, I don't want to make you a martyr, Mr. Mayor. I simply want you to back up all those fine words of conciliation and submission with some positive action. Let me show you how that's achieved. He twisted around in the chair and smiled at Francine, who was still standing in the middle of the little garden. No! Miles shouted. He began to lunge forward, but a heavy skin hand clamped down hard on his shoulder. It was impossible to shift. His vision blurred with tears as the hand gripped tighter. He was sure his collarbone was about to snap. Every Zhang beckoned. Francine gave him a sullen, rebellious look, then gently put her sister down and whispered a few words in her ear. Melanie ran away across the garden, disappearing through a door on the other side. Francine straightened her back and walked into the study. "I have a gift for you, my dear," Every Zhang said. The loop of plastic came open. "For fuck's sake," Miles shouted. "She's only 15." Francine gave her father a brave little smile. "It's all right, Daddy." She knelt in front of the governor, who put the length of plastic round her neck. The two ends melded together, and it contracted until it was tight against her skin. "I know," Every Zhang said sympathetically. "You want to kill me." Francine ran across the room and threw her arms around Miles. He clung to her, stroking her chestnut hair. "If anything happens to her, you will die," he told the governor, "and it will be neither quick nor painless." It was one of Mimu Bay's attractive wide boulevards in the center of town, the pavements lined with tall, sturdy trees whose canopy of leaves created a pleasant, dappled shade for pedestrians. Carl Sheehan walked along the center of the tram lines, praying that some shithead civilian would try to trip him up or just look at him funny. Anything that would give him a legitimate excuse to smash some local bastard's skull open. He wanted revenge for Nick, no matter what the price. They'd left Amersey and the kid standing guard over the body to continue their deployment pattern. Carl had argued against that. They should all stay. It was respect, if nothing else. But the goddamn Sarge had insisted they carry on. So they'd taken their assigned streets, and now he was supposed to be checking for signs of organized resistance. At least the anger was helping to cover his nerves, some of them. God damn, this bunch of fishfuckers had guns that could shoot through skin as if it weren't there. That was bad, real bad. It meant they'd all be vulnerable right up until the moment the guys from intelligence tracked down the cache. They'd do that, though. They would find it. He had to believe that. Intelligence division was creepy but effective. In the meantime, he had to walk about in the open with his ass hanging out, ready for someone to kick. Bad, bad, bad. He kept a keen lookout as he walked along, scanning anything that looked remotely like a rifle barrel. His punch pistol was held high and prominent. So far, it looked like it was intimidating people like it was supposed to. They were all staying indoors, glancing out at him through windows. There'd been a few catcalls, but that was all. News about the shooting had flooded the local data pool. That and the mass darting had cleared people off the streets pretty fast. Some old geezer shuffled out of a side road, a walking stick waving about aggressively in front of him, acting like he owned the place. Carl kept walking. "Hey, you, Sonny," the old man called. "What?" The old man had stopped at the edge of the pavement. "Come here." Carl swore inside his helmet and angled his walk so he'd pass close. "What do you want?"
"I'm looking for your mother."
Carl's sensors zoomed in for a closer look. The old man really was ancient, probably caught too much sun over the years.
"My mother?"
"Yes. She pimps your sister, doesn't she? I want to know how much she charges. I'd like to give you people a good fucking."
Carl's fists clenched. The skin AS had to modify his grip on the punch pistol to prevent him from crushing the casing. "Get back to the nut house, you old fart." He turned away and started walking. Goddamn parasite colony bastards. He never did understand why ZB didn't just gamma-soak the whole lot of them and send down its own people to run the factories. The walking stick whistled through the air to crack across Carl's back. His carapace didn't even have to harden to protect him.
"God damn! Stop that, crazy old bastard!"
"They're going to bury him here, Sonny."
The stick had a pointed end, which the old man was now using to try to gouge out one of the helmet sensors.
"Stop that!"
Carl gave him a light shove. He nearly fell backward, but quickly regained his balance to make another stab with the stick.
"You can't take the bodies home. They weigh too much. And ZB's too cheap. Your friend will have to be buried here. I'm going to dig him up again when you're gone."
"Fuck off."
Carl swatted the walking stick away.
"We'll piss on him and use what's left of his skull as a trophy. And we'll laugh about how he died, with shit dribbling out of his ass and pain blowing his brain apart."
"Bastard!"
Carl grabbed the insane old jerk and drew his fist back. The old man started a cackling chuckle.
"Carl?"
Lawrence asked.
"Carl, what's going on?"
That goddamn suit telemetry circuit. Carl had lost count of the number of times he'd wanted to rip it out. He took a breath, his fist still cocked back.
"Caught a ringleader, Sarge. He knows about the gun they used."
"Carl, he's about 2,000 years old. Put him down."
"He knows."
"Carl.
Don't let them get to you like this. It's what they want.
Yes, sir.
Carl let go of the old man, then realized there was a form of revenge available to him. Hey, fuckface, you're my trophy now. How do you like that, huh? He opened the pouch on his belt and pulled out a collateral necklace. The deranged old fool just kept laughing at him the whole time he fitted the thing around his neck, as if it were the best thing that could ever happen. Michelle Rake had spent the whole morning sitting on her bed, hugging her legs. She was fully dressed, but couldn't bring herself to venture out from the little apartment. Some of the other students in the residence house had gone out to see the invaders march through Durrell. Michelle knew what that meant. They'd end up throwing stones at the terrifying Earth Army troops, who would shoot them with agonizing stun bullets and drag them away to have explosive collars fastened around their necks. So she had kept indoors and accessed the data pool news services. That way, she'd been given a close-up view of the drop gliders landing on the edge of town and disgorging thousands of the big skin-clad troops who had promptly swarmed along the streets. And she was right. People had lobbed rocks and bottles and even some kind of firebomb. Barricades were thrown up across streets, then set on fire. The troops just walked through as if it were rain, not flame. Nothing affected them or slowed them down. There had been other forms of resistance. The news reported that one of the spaceport's hydrogen storage tanks had exploded. A few civic buildings had been set on fire, sending up thick columns of smoke over the capital city. The data pool was slow, and sometimes her connection dropped out for minutes at a time as strange software battles were fought within the city's electronic shadow. A quarter of an hour after the gliders arrived, small pods full of equipment fell out of the sky, dangling beneath big, gaudy yellow parachutes. They were all drifting into the parks and meadows to the west of Durrell. Cameras followed several whose chutes had tangled, hurtling down to smash apart in a cascade of metal and plastic fragments. To start with, she'd kept a line open to her parents over at Colmore, a settlement 2,000 kilometers to the south. It might have been weak of her, but they understood how frightened she was by the invasion. This was her first year at the university, and she didn't make friends too well. All she wanted was to go home, but the commercial flights had all stopped within half a day of the starships being detected. She was stuck here for the duration. Every time she thought about it, she told herself that she was an adult and should be able to cope. Then she started crying. Durrell was the capital. There would be more of the invaders here than anywhere else. Everything was bigger in Durrell, including the potential for trouble. An hour after the drop gliders landed, her link to Colmore was cut. Nothing she could do would bring it back. The data pool management AS kept saying that the satellite links were down. Nothing about how or why they were down. She'd hugged herself tighter, flinching at every tiny sound in the building. Her imagination filled the stairs and corridors with skin suits as the invaders dragged students out of their rooms and snapped the explosive collars around their necks. They do it because everyone knew students always caused trouble and rioted and demonstrated, and campus was a perpetual hotbed of revolutionaries. There was a knock at the door. Michelle squealed in shock. The knock came again. She stared across the room at the door. There was nowhere for her to hide, no way she could escape. She uncurled and stood up. The knock came again. It didn't sound authoritative or impatient. Hating herself for being so fearful, she padded across the threadbare carpet and turned the lock. "It's open," she whispered. She was trembling as if the world were in winter, while the door slowly swung back. Somebody was standing there, giving her a curious look. He was so totally out of context that she thought her feverish brain was producing hallucinations. "Joseph?" she muttered. "Hi, babe." "Oh, my God, it's you." She jumped at him, clutching him so hard she would surely squeeze him to death. But, Joseph! They'd met that summer while she was on vacation, celebrating her entrance exams. The first vacation she'd ever had by herself. It had been the most incredible time. Before then, she'd always laughed at the cliched stupidity of a vacation romance. But this had been different. She really had fallen in love. And at night, she'd almost been frightened by her body's passion, The things they did with each other in her hotel bed. Almost. Leaving Memu Bey had torn her very soul in half. She sobbed helplessly as he held on to her.
"I thought you were one of them," she babbled. "I thought I was going to be made a hostage."
"No, no." His hands stroked her back. "It's only me."
"How did you get here? Why are you here?"
"Oh, Joseph, I've been so frightened."
"I caught the last flight out of Memu Bay. I told you I wanted to come with you and enroll at the university here. I just decided to leave the diving school when these ZB bastards arrived."
"You came here for me?"
He took both of her hands, pressing them together inside his own until they stopped shaking. "Of course I did. I couldn't forget you, not ever." She started crying again. He kissed her gently on the brow, then moved down her cheek. Each touch of his lips was like a blessing.
He was here, wonderful Joseph with his strong, exciting body.
And all the badness that had fallen upon their world wouldn't, couldn't touch her anymore. Steve Anders made his way carefully down the concrete steps into the basement underneath the bar. The concrete steps had worn and crumbled in the coastal humidity, making them treacherous. He hadn't even known the bar had such a room underneath, but then it was a long time since he'd been in one of the tourist traps along the marina waterfront. His walking stick tapped its way gingerly across each curved surface before he put his feet down. At his age, he didn't want to risk a broken bone. He chuckled at that. It was his age that had brought him here. By God, it was good to be helping fight back against the swine who'd killed his son last time around. Good that he could do something, that his age was finally an asset. It was a typical bar's storage room, crates of empty and full bottles stacked against the walls, a trap door with a power platform to bring the beer barrels in and out, broken chairs, advertising placards from years ago, boxes of old tankards, torn sheet screens rolled up and stuffed behind a pile of elaborate clay pots that still held desiccated plants. He reached the floor and peered around the gloomy shapes. The place was lit by a single green-tinged light cone.
"Hello, Mr. Anders."
He squinted at the girl who came out of the shadows.
"Pretty young thing."
"I know you," he said. "You're the school teacher."
"Best not to label people," Denise said.
"Yes,
yes, of course, I'm sorry."
"That's all right. I thank you for what you've done. It was very brave."
"Fa!"
His free hand came up automatically to stroke the plastic collateral necklace.
"It was easy enough to get, and I had fun annoying that young shit who put it on me."
Denise smiled and indicated a chair. Steve nodded gruffly, covering his rising nerves, and sat down. He watched with interest as she took a standard desktop pearl from her canvas shoulder bag. The unit was a rectangle of black plastic, fractionally larger than her hand, with its pane furled up along one edge.
Nothing special.
She put it on her open palm as if she were holding an injured bird. Her eyes closed, and the slightest frown creased her forehead. Steve Anders wished he were 60 years younger. She was enchanting. Some young lad didn't know how lucky he was. The desktop pearl changed shape, stiff plastic flowing into a crescent with needle-sharp tips.
"That's unusual," Steve said, trying to keep his voice light.
Before he'd retired, he'd been a protein cell technician. Nothing fancy, just a time server at Memu Bay's food refinery. But he knew Thallspring's level of technology. Denise's eyes fluttered open.
"Yes. Are you ready?"
Steve suddenly had a lot more confidence he was going to live through this.
"Go ahead."
Denise brought the device up and touched its tips to the collateral necklace. Steve tried to look down at what was happening.
"It is melding with their systems," she said, understanding his apprehension.
"By echoing them, we can understand their function. Once that state has been reached, they lie open to us."
"It sounds more like philosophy than hacking."
Did she mean duplicating their software or hardware?
Either way, he'd never heard of a gadget that acted the way this one did. It excited him and disturbed him at the same time.
There we are, she said contentedly. The necklace loosened its grip. Denise took it from his neck. Steve let out a whoosh of breath. He saw that the tips of her gadget had sprouted a kind of root network, fibers as thin as human hair that dipped into the necklace plastic. No, nothing native to Thallspring could do that. That's it? He asked. That's it. Chapter 7 The scrum downformed with a hefty bone-cruncher thud as the heads of the prop forward locked together. Each of the boys tensed, gritting their teeth, breathing hard as they waited for the scrum half to slip the ball in. From his flanker's position, Lawrence could just see through the tangle of mud-smeared legs. The ball was a blur of darkness as it entered the narrow gap. He yelled with the effort as he helped his teammates push. The hookers went after the ball like a pair of human jackhammers. Lawrence's boots began to skid backward. The Lairfold team's prop forwards were the biggest, supposed 18-year-olds Lawrence had ever seen. The Hillary Air High first 15 were losing almost every scrum, and it was costing them in points. This time Nigel, the Air's hooker, managed to snag the ball for his team. It went sneaking back through the second row. The Lairfold team saw what was happening and started to wheel the scrum. Rob snatched the ball out of the second row and gave it a flying pass out to the Air's wing just before he vanished below the painful slam down of the enraged Lairfold scrum half. The scrum broke apart with jostling aggravation, and the heavy boys began to lumber out toward the wingers who were running with the ball. It was passed three times before Allen caught it just short of the halfway line. He was smaller than most of the team, but his stocky frame carried a lot of strength. He sprinted downfield faster than the opposition expected. The 20 boys converging on him had to alter direction, gaining him a few extra seconds before one of Lairfold's flankers crashed into him. It was a tumbling impact, both boys leaving the ground, legs akimbo. The ball flew straight and purposeful out of the melee, with Allen screaming, "Go, you fucker!" And Lawrence caught it without even stopping. He pounded toward the Lairfold goal line. The cheering from the touchline rose to a bombardment of yells, catcalls, and chants. Out of the corner of his eye, he just saw the scarlet and turquoise pom-poms sashaying about as the Air's cheerleaders gave it their raucous all. Couldn't make out which one was Rosalind. Then he saw the Lairfold fullback coming straight at him, and the lanky bastard was faster. He wasn't going to make the touchdown. On the other side of the pitch, Vinnie Carlton was keeping pace with Lawrence's dash, making sure he didn't get in front. 2 seconds before the fullback tackled him, Lawrence turned and flung the ball. The fullback's arms wrapped around his legs, and he crashed to the sodden grass with a bruising impact. The ball arced across the field, turning slowly end over end. Everyone watched its silent flight. Even the supporters on the sideline abandoned their clamor. Vinnie carried on running, and the Lairfold team noticed him. Their guerrilla men prop forward bellowed a furious war cry, but nobody was even close. Vinnie caught the ball beautifully, 10 paces from the line. He sailed over with a joyful whoop, holding it aloft as he pelted in toward the big goal posts, slamming it down onto the grass. The crowd was jubilant. Lawrence laughed madly as he clambered out from under the angry fullback. His ribs and shoulder hurt like a bastard, and the tackle had left him partly winded, but he was still clapping and hollering in elation. The Ayers team swooped on Vinnie, who hugged Lawrence. "Great pass, man." "Better try." "1 point down," Allen said, always eager to spread gloom. Lawrence shook his head. "Two up, you mean? No sweat. Richard'll get it." They walked back toward their own half as Richard hacked into the ground with his heel, then carefully stood the ball upright. Lairfold lined up between the goal, facing him. But for Richard, Ayers' prize kicker, the 3-point goal was a simple jog forward and a swift boot. The ball flew sedately between the tall white posts. There was another 3 minutes left to the game. Ayers played it tactfully, not giving ground, kicking it into touch, holding the ball in the scrum. The referee blew the whistle. Both captains did the gentlemanly thing and shook hands in the middle of the pitch. Lawrence stood with his teammates and gave their opponents 3 hearty cheers as they left the field. Alan was laughing cruelly. Look at them, bunch of jerk-offs. Go home and kill yourselves, guys. Nigel's hand clamped over his mouth. Show some dignity, man. I am, Alan smirked. I'm fucking enjoying myself. I love it when people that arrogant take a dive. Hey, man of the match. John wrapped an arm around Vinny's shoulder and pulled his hair down over his face. What a run! Vinny grinned happily. Wouldn't have meant a thing without Lawrence. Lawrence put on his most humble tone. I do what I can. Yeah, Alan grunted. Only if Rosalind lets you. Several of the cheerleaders were running across the field to greet their heroes. They were dressed in short scarlet skirts and cornflower blue sports halters. Now that's what I call a welcome home, Alan said. His laugh was like a bad case of hiccups. He put his arms out wide and ran toward them. They scattered. Rosalind swatted him with a pom-pom and danced around to reach Lawrence. You won, she squeaked as she kissed Lawrence. It was a team effort. No, it wasn't. It was your brilliant throw that clinched it. I saw it all. You were magnificent. Kiss me. Oh, for fuck's sake, Alan grumbled. He ambled off toward the changing room. Lawrence and Rosalind laughed at his departing back. Ugh, you're filthy, she complained suddenly. Streaks of cold, wet mud from his shirt had soaked into her halter. Go and wash. Yes, ma'am. Be quick. It's freezing out here. She rubbed her arms and gave the dome's conditioning fans a suspicious glance. The school always lowered the temperature for rugby and soccer so the players wouldn't get too hot, but this felt as if the atmosphere had circumvented the inlet grids to blow straight in. Are you going to the party tonight? Nadia asked. She was leaning against Vinny with his arm casually possessive around her waist, but it was Lawrence who was receiving her intense stare. Yeah, sure, he said, very careful to keep the tone neutral. Rosalind seemed to have some kind of telepathic ability when it came to detecting his thoughts on other girls. Not that he did have thoughts on other girls, of course. Funny thing was, for years not a single girl at Hillary Air High had shown any interest in him whatsoever. But now he had Rosalind, he'd started to get definite signals. Not just from Nadia, either. See you later, Rosalind said. She turned, then bounded back. One more kiss. He obliged. So, is she pregnant yet? Alan asked in the locker room. What? Who? Lawrence had showered, managing to grab someone else's shampoo. Now he was toweling his hair dry beside his locker. Rosalind. No. So what's all the practice for? Alan's question trailed off into his hiccup laugh. God, you're such a pervert. God? Ah, this would be Rosalind's God you've borrowed, would it? Fuck off. Listen. Alan's voice rose in volume so he could appeal to the rest of the locker room. 3 times I asked if he was coming out for an evening last week. Every time. His voice became all whiny. I can't. We have to study together. Which bit of her were you studying? Rob shouted. Yeah, Nigel laughed. Don't you know all the working parts yet? Fuck off, Lawrence yelled at him, hoping he wasn't grinning too much. It was quite a prestige thing, having a girlfriend for so long that everyone knew for sure that the relationship was solidly physical. They're just jealous, Vinny said. Freaks without chicks. Lawrence gave him a small bow. Thank you. He liked Vinny Carleton. The boy had arrived on Amathai only 18 months ago, just after Rosalind's family, but already it was as if he'd been there forever. Lawrence had started getting pally with him around the same time he was reintegrating himself with his own peers. Vinny didn't have any family in Templeton. His father was still back on Earth, wrapping up contracts for his software business before flying out to live permanently on Amathai. As Vinny was 17 when he disembarked the starship, he was legally able to live without any guardian supervision. He had his own apartment, and some legal firm took care of his finances and other official stuff, such as getting him a place at school. Lawrence had been incredibly jealous of that apartment at first. But they had a lot in common. Shared academic classes, both in the flight club Vinny had actually flown an aircraft back on Earth, he claimed. Got roped into the same team games, enjoyed duking it out in the eyes together. They even looked similar, though Lawrence's hair was a couple of shades lighter, and Vinny's eyes were deep brown instead of gray-green. "I think you're cousins," Rosalind had once said. Lawrence laughed at that and said, "No way." Although a couple of months after they'd been hanging out together, he did ask Vinny about his family. That was when he discovered the Carltons were the ones who'd imported halo stars to Amethi, which made Vinny a seriously good person to know. He got the upgrades before anyone else. Not that Lawrence was playing the eyes anything like as much as he used to. He simply didn't have the time these days. "Alan, we've got to find you a girl before your mind goes into meltdown from hormone overload," Vinny said. "You're getting worse every day. You're coming tonight, aren't you?" "Course I am. This party was my goddamn idea, remember?" Lawrence could remember Rosalind and Nadia saying the team should all go out together after the game to either celebrate or commiserate. He chose not to mention it at that point. "We should ask a few extra girls along," Richard said. The idea of Richard even knowing a few extra girls was also something Lawrence kept quiet about. Richard had been going steady with Barbara for ages. One extra girl, and she'd kill him. "Don't you worry about me, mate," Alan said in his most annoyingly cocky voice. "I've got a foolproof system to get laid." "What?" Nigel snorted. It was supposed to be contemptuous, but a small note of interest had crept in. The changing room magically quietened down as the other guys in the team just happened to overhear Alan's brag. Not that any of them needed a system, but it never hurt to know. "Simple," Alan said, delighted by his audience. "My mate Steve, you remember him, the bright one that went to university last year? Yeah, well, he swears this works. He does it all the time. You go into the party and look around to find the most beautiful girl there. Then you walk straight up to her and say, 'Will you sleep with me tonight?'" There was a moment of silence as the rugby team absorbed this news. "Crap. You asshole. That's such a bunch of shit." A shoe thrown by a disbeliever hit Alan's leg. He yelped and searched around for the offender. "Hey, look, I'm not kidding around here," he exclaimed. "Steve says it works. He gets laid every weekend. Seriously." "Oh, yeah," John jeered. "And the most beautiful girl in the room takes one look at a toxic midget like you and just says yes." "Well, maybe," Alan said, "if you get really lucky. I think I'll stick to the traditional method of giving her too much to drink," Lawrence muttered. The noise level rose. People started getting dressed again. "Hey, listen," Alan protested. "This is statistics. That's solid mathematics. It can't fail." "But you just said this mythical supermodel was likely to turn you down," Nigel complained. "So it doesn't matter. You find the second most beautiful girl and ask her the same thing. If she says no, you just keep moving along down the beauty scale until one of them says yes." John's expression was pitying. "Alan, none of them are going to say yes. Not to that." "Yes, they will. They're at the party for exactly the same reason we are. It's just that they're not as honest about it as we are."
"You're lecturing on honesty," Lawrence said. "Oh, my sweet fate, we're doomed."
"Girls like you being honest," Alan insisted. "They like politeness and flattery a lot more," Richard said. "Most of them, most of the time, yeah. But this is a party, right? They've been drinking. The evening's moving on, and they haven't scored yet. One of them's bound to say yes. It's statistics, I told you." Vinny's despair had caused his head to sink into his hands. "Alan," he asked, "do you ever wonder why you haven't got a girlfriend yet?"
"Hey, I've had hundreds of girls, okay?"
"When?" Lawrence demanded. "Tell us when this system ever got you a girl."
"Tonight."
"I knew it. You're talking bullshit."
"Durr, no. This is completely for real. Steve's screwed half the babes on campus. It's amazing. You just got to have the balls to use it."
"Your balls have got to be where your brain is before you use it, more likely," John grunted dourly. Alan jabbed his thumb proudly against his chest.
Listen, mate, I'm the one that's going to get laid tonight. It's you, Sad Joes, who'll be left propping up the bar and going home all by yourselves. I'm telling you, it works. The party, like all parties, started out with good intentions. At 7:30, the first 15 team and friends headed over to Hilliers, which was in a dome they could all walk to. It was a big old club buried under a residential tower, with three main oval-shaped sections comprising lounge, dance floor, and brasserie. They joined together at a central circular bar. In its heyday, Hilliers had been the center for younger members of board families, a place where the jazzy hung out and the pool sharks lay in wait. But time and fashion had moved on. Now it was the even younger members of second echelon families who congregated there in the evening. They, of course, thought it was superb, a real nightclub that didn't kick up a fuss and ask for proof of age at the door. Hilliers couldn't afford to get that choosy about its paying customers anymore, and these kids did seem to have access to large amounts of money. The plan was to start with a meal, then move on to a drinking and dancing session. When Lawrence arrived, the boys were all in the lounge, having a drink before hitting the brasserie for something to eat. "You're late," Benny said. He was already on his second beer. "I had some news," Lawrence said modestly. He thought he was in for another lecture when he got home after the match. His father had called him up into the study, and he was never summoned there for any other reason. But when he arrived, his father was smiling as he held out a sheet of hard copy. "Thought you might want to see this," Doug Newton said blithely. Lawrence took the sheet from his father with some trepidation and began to read. It was a provisional acceptance from Templeton University, offering him a place to study general science and managerial strategy. Doug clapped his son on the back. "You did it, my boy. Congratulations. I didn't even have to pull any strings." Lawrence had just stared at the sheet, elated and frightened by what it meant. Everybody applied to Templeton University. The candidate rejection rate was 80%. "Only if I get the qualifying grades in my final exams," he said cautiously. "Lawrence, Lawrence, what are we going to do with you? You'll get them. We both know that. The way you've turned your schoolwork around these last couple of years, you'll probably get a distinction." He gripped his son's shoulders. "I'm proud of you. Genuinely proud." "Thanks, Dad." "You off to celebrate tonight? I heard you won the game." "Some of us are thinking of going down to Hilliers, yeah." "That old place still going, huh? Ah, well, good for you. But I think you deserve something a bit more tangible for this result. I booked you in for 10 days at Orchie. You can go skiing on Barclays. How does that sound?"
"Pretty amazing." His enthusiasm faded.
It's for two," Doug said gently. "If you have a friend you'd like to take." Lawrence looked around Hilliers Lounge. "Where's Rosalind?"
"Haven't seen her yet."
Nigel signaled the barmaid for two beers. She was in her mid-twenties and immune from his hopeful boyish smiles.
"Oh,"
Lawrence kept looking.
"What about Alan?" "Am I your personal news trawler? He's around somewhere, talking to a girl."
"What?" Lawrence gaped at Nigel. "You don't mean his system worked?"
"Oh, get fucking real," Nigel exclaimed.
The barmaid frowned at his language and put the beers down in front of him without saying a word. Nigel winced at her departing back, then glared at Lawrence.
"Thanks."
"You're as bad as Alan. A girl like that, and you, is never going to happen."
"Maybe if I left a big tip."
"Don't even think it." Lawrence picked up his glass and took a sip. The beer was so cold it disguised any taste.
"So how is Alan doing?"
"One slap on the face, two cocktails thrown at him, and he's been told to piss off a few times as well," Vinny said happily. "We're thinking of running a book on it." "Put me down for a day 5 years hence." Lawrence saw Rosalind moving across the lounge and waved. She was in a green dress that had a big oval patch open at the front to show off her navel. Whatever she wore, she always looked sensational. It was just a knack she had.
But as usual, it made Lawrence terribly self-conscious about his own clothes. He worried that his bronze shimmer jacket would look awfully crass beside her. Rosalind arrived at the bar at the same time Alan staggered in from the other side. A long strip of pink toilet paper was tucked into the back of his trousers. Half of the lounge clientele was mesmerized by this flimsy tale sliding along the floor behind him. "Damn it," Alan whined. "They're all playing hard to get." "Who are?" Rosalind asked. "All the babes." Alan glanced around accusingly at his friends. "Did you guys warn them?" Nigel bent over, his face radiating martyred dismay, and tugged the toilet paper free. "We didn't have to." "What?" Alan did a double take at the paper. "Oh, thanks. It must have got stuck in my cleft, my round." He clicked his fingers loudly at the barmaid. "Oi, how about some service?" "I have some news," Lawrence told Rosalind. She grinned. "Me too."
"You first."
"No, you."
They both laughed.
"Ladies first," Lawrence said.
"I'm going to throw up," Alan muttered.
"Okay." Rosalind fished round in her small handbag and produced a memory chip. "I'm late because I was downloading this from the Ilian's communication AS. It's just arrived in orbit. Judith sent me another series."
Lawrence gaped in wonder. He took the chip from her hands with a great deal of reverence. "Series 6? He asked.
"Uh-huh."
She accepted a margarita from John and carefully wiped the salt from a section of the rim.
"The last one."
"Hell fire. The final episode. I wonder if they get home." Rosalind cocked an eyebrow demurely.
"Only one way to find out. Oh, and there was some stuff from the fan site, too. Half a dozen series-related eye games, I think, and a whole load of generated graphic follow-ons."
"Fantastic."
"Damn,"
Alan grinned at Rosalind.
"This is a moment like that stunt your god does. What is it? Oh, yeah, he turns up again or something.
The second coming of the Christ, a time of revelation throughout the universe."
"That's the one." Alan raised his beer glass. "Here's to Lawrence finally finding out what happened to a bunch of jerk-off actors when they asked for a pay raise in Series 7.
"There was a proper story arc," Lawrence protested. Too late, he realized, the fatal mistake of letting Alan know you cared about something.
"Oh-ho! I was right. It's a revelation. Please, Lawrence, do us all a big favor and get a life."
"Alan?" Rosalind asked, in a voice tensed with curiosity.
"Do you know that girl?"
"Which one?"
"Over there, in the blue top."
"Her?" His glass slopped around in the girl's general direction as he laughed his short, dirty laugh.
"Damn, see what you mean. Two puppies wrestling in a blue sack."
Rosalind's face remained serene.
"Yes, her."
"Never seen her before in my life, Your Honor, and I would definitely remember." He drained the last of his beer and burped. Fortunately, he'd ordered too many, so there was a fresh glass he could lift straight off the bar. Over Alan's head, Lawrence gave Vinny a frantic grimace and mouthed.
"When did he start?"
Vinny shrugged helplessly.
"She's been looking at you," Rosalind said.
"Fuck. Really?" Alan laughed again and poked Richard in the chest.
"I told you, it's statistics."
He straightened himself up and walked over to the girl. There was a momentary flash of panic on her face when she saw him approach.
"Remind me never to annoy you," Nigel told Rosalind.
Lawrence was wincing as he followed Alan's progress.
"I'm not sure I can watch this. The pain level's too high." "So, what did you want to tell me?" Rosalind asked.
"Oh, yes." The joy returned to Lawrence's life. He pocketed the memory chip.
"I got a letter from Templeton University today."
Rosalind's gaze was one of pure admiration as he explained about his preliminary acceptance and the skiing trip.
"I knew you could do it, Lawrence," she murmured quietly.
"Well done." She kissed him just below his ear.
"What about your mother?"
he asked apprehensively.
Do you think she'll let you come to Orchy with me?
You leave her to me.
His hands went around her, pressing into the small of her back.
Sounds good to me.
They kissed. He could taste the sharp tang of the margarita on her lips.
Guys, I think we should get over there, Vinny said.
Alan was so engrossed with making obscene small talk to the girl in the blue top that he hadn't noticed her boyfriend standing behind him.
No way, John was shaking his head. Look at the effing size of him.
Bigger they are, the harder they fall, Rob declared. He was almost as drunk as Alan.
As long as he falls on you, not me, Nigel said.
He's our friend, Lawrence said. Somehow he couldn't summon up much conviction. The boyfriend had a couple of friends with him, too.
Just tell the bar staff, Rosalind said urgently. The bouncers will sort it out.
Too late, Benny groaned. Alan had finally noticed the boyfriend. They looked on incredulously as their friend employed his own never-fail method of getting out of sticky situations by telling the one about the parrot and the starship stewardess.
The airlock slammed shut, and as they were tumbling through interstellar space, the bloke turned to the parrot and said, "Pretty ballsy for a guy with no spacesuit."
Alan giggled hysterically at the punchline.
The boyfriend, it turned out, didn't have much of a sense of humor.
Lawrence finally got home at 3:30 in the morning, after his father and the family lawyer bailed him out from the police station. Amethyst's turbulent climate was changing again, emerging from its snowfall phase. Over the last few years, billions of tons of water had been liberated from Barclay's glacier as the melt-off accelerated. The contribution it made to atmospheric pressure and density was small, but effective. Thicker and heavier, the planet's envelope of gas now retained more heat than before. Overall, temperature was up by a couple of degrees. On the side of the planet away from the glacier, the snow was giving way to rain. Templeton even had weeks of broken cloud cover as the winds slowly strengthened. A lot of people saw that as a bad omen, predicting the awakening would end in hurricanes ripping the domes apart. The official line was that increased airspeed was a natural and inevitable part of acquiring a normal weather pattern. There might be a few peaks on the graph along the way, but it would level out in the end. Whether you believed that or not, the clearer skies did mean that passenger jets were returning to commercial service after their near hiatus of the preceding years. Lawrence and Rosalind caught the morning flight out from Templeton, taking 15 hours to reach Oxendale. One day Oxendale would be the major city on a long chain of islands in the middle of the ocean. For the moment, it was sitting on the top of a massive flat-topped mountain, the largest in a ridge of similar mountains rising out from a slushy saltwater quagmire. On this side of the planet, facing Nisana, the glacier still dominated the environment. The air was a lot colder, and clouds still sprinkled snow as they migrated out to the warmer tropics. Their jet touched down on a runway that was coated in white powdery ice. They glimpsed it only a few seconds before the wheels hit. For the last hour, they'd been flying blind through thick fog. Oxendale's altitude, a kilometer above the salty marsh, meant that it was almost permanently in the clouds. They had a half-hour wait in the airport lounge while their luggage was transferred. Then they trooped on board a 30-seater STL plane built for Arctic conditions. Orchy was another 2 hours' flying time away. 40 minutes after takeoff, they cleared the base of the cloud layer to see Barclay's glacier in the distance. With Amethi a quarter of the way around its orbit from Superior Conjunction, the sun was shining almost directly onto the vertical cliff face of the glacier. It split the land from the sky with a silver-white glare stretching from north to south, as if a crack had appeared in the landscape to allow another, closer sun to shine through from behind the planet. Lawrence had to put his sunglasses on to look at it directly. Colors here were all monotone. The surface of the glacier was pure white. Even the clouds didn't seem to cast a shadow. Features, at least from this distance, were non-existent. The most that could be said was that the ice was rumpled,
with long, gentle curves overlapping all the way to the boundary. Overhead, the sky shone with an astonishingly bright metallic blue sheen. Nisana's dominant ochre crescent appeared intrusively alien, its darkness in some way negative. Squashed streamers of cloud swirled about, almost as bright as the glacier itself. All of them were sliding in the same direction, out from the ice shelf and away over the ocean floor. When Lawrence looked straight down, he could see nothing but dunes of slick auburn mud, their crests dusted white. Slivers of grubby water shimmered in the cirques amid the dunes, forming an infinite plexus of connected rills. Every few kilometers there would be a deep river cutting its way through the mud. Here the water was fast-flowing and filthy, clawing at the gully sides to loosen great swaths of mud. Lumps of ice bobbed along, colliding against each other with enough violence to produce small explosions of splinters, or even split apart. For all the physical activity, the vista got to Lawrence. He used to think the tundra desert outside Templeton was bleak, but this was pure desolation. There was no sign here that any of the terraforming algae had ever bloomed in the slushy puddles, no meandering tracks of slow-life organisms as they impregnated the mud with their spores and bacteria. This was impassive, ancient geology at its most aloof, untouched by life's Machiavellian tendrils. It made him feel small, irrelevant. After a while, the little aircraft curved around and headed in over the glacier. A lot of the edge was still sheer cliff, but a quantity had crumbled into giant talus falls extending for kilometers out into the mud. The top of the glacier was bisected by deep rifts that carried the rivers out from the interior. Some of these fractured canyons were over a kilometer deep and still expanding as the water gnawed away at their floor, but that still left them terminating high over the ocean floor. The edge of Barclay's glacier was host to the most spectacular array of waterfalls on any known world. Over 1,000 prodigious rivers ended abruptly hundreds of meters above the ground, projecting their waters in monumental arcs to thunder into ragged craters gouged out by their own relentless torrent. The town of Orchy was situated on the top of one of these rifts, Coniston's Flaw, a long, jagged gully extending well over 1,000 kilometers toward the east. In some places it was over 3 kilometers wide, its steep, angled sides resembling the alpine valleys of France and Switzerland. Orchy was currently sitting on top of a broad, curving section, with the river churning along the rift floor 600 meters below. The curve meant that the water constantly chewed into the ice, an erosion that pulled down vast avalanches from the sides. Once they'd settled, they were excellent skiing slopes, although the flow of water that created them would ultimately undermine them, changing the valley's profile once again. The entire length of Coniston's Flaw was a variable geometry, flexing in month-long undulations, with only its terminal waterfall holding reasonably steady. Even the tributaries would forsake it after abrupt and violent shifts, defecting to other rivers. Orchy moved to accommodate these whims, a truly mobile town, made up from oblong building modules that could be carried by large flatbed trucks. Whenever the slopes decayed or quaked or collapsed, the silvery modules would be unbolted and hauled along the top of the flaw to the next suitable site. The STL plane extended its ski blade undercarriage and skidded along a length of flat ice marked out by flare strobes. Fans howled as the AS pilot reversed pitch and brought them to a halt at the center of a micro-blizzard. A bus took them into town, dropping them off at the Hypatia Hotel. It was identical to every other cluster of metal modules that made up the town. They were laid out in a fat fishbone pattern, standing on legs that left a 70-centimeter gap between the floor base and the ice. Reception was at one end of the spine, with the bar, lounge, and dining room at the other. The interior was smart without being ostentatious. It reminded Lawrence of aircraft furnishing. Their room was made up of 3 modules, which gave them a bedroom, a small bathroom, and what the bellboy insisted on calling a veranda room. It was essentially an alcove with lounger chairs and a wide floor-to-ceiling triple-glazed window giving them a view out across Coniston's Flaw. "Wonder what old Barclay would make of this," Lawrence mused. Thick clouds were boiling overhead, but they were pure white, fluoresced by the sun. Ice and snow gleamed underneath, making it difficult to know where the horizon was. Orchy was at the center of its own little closed, radiant universe. With his new sunglasses, Lawrence could just make out tiny dark figures zipping down the slopes below the hotel. "I think he'd be impressed," Rosalind said. Her dimples had returned as she took in the view. "I am." He glanced around the room. "Not quite up to the same standard as Ulfgarth." "We'll have to make do." She offered him a small jeweler's box. "What's this?" "Open it." There was a slim silver necklace inside with a hologram pendant. When he held it up to the light, a small Rosalind in a blue dress smiled at him from inside the plastic. "So I can be with you all the time," she said, suddenly bashful. "Thanks." He slipped the chain round his neck and fastened the clasp. "I'll never take it off." Her hand turned his head to face her, and they kissed passionately. He began tugging at her blouse. "Wait," she murmured. "I'll just be a moment." Lawrence did his best not to show his frustration as she picked up a bag and went into the bathroom. "You could get ready, too," she said as she slid the door closed. "And I like the lights low, remember?" He stared after her for a second, then raced over to the door and locked it. Over to the big veranda windows and opaqued them, swept the hand luggage off the bed, pulled the cover onto the floor, struggled to push his trousers down, dancing on one foot when his shoe became stuck, got a shirt sleeve caught as he pulled it off over his head, set the communication panel to call guard, landed hard on the bed and let out a small whoop of delight when the mattress rippled underneath him, plumped up the pillows and flopped back onto them, hands behind his head, grinning oafishly at the ceiling. 10 days. Rosalind walked out of the bathroom. She was wearing a white silk negligee that couldn't have weighed more than 10 grams. He'd never been so scared of her sexuality before. "You're magnificent," he whispered. She sat on the side of the bed. When he rose up to embrace her, she held up a finger, shaking her head softly. He let himself down again, not sure how long his self-control would last. "I so hoped you would enjoy me like this," she said quietly. "Fair chance I wouldn't." He broke off at the slight frown on her face. She reached out with one hand to touch the pendant, then gently traced the shape of his pectoral muscles. "I wore this because I wanted to please you. I need you to know how much tonight means to me."
"It means a lot to me, too."
"Does it, Lawrence?" Her hand stroked down his abdomen. The eroticism of the motion was an insanely beautiful torture. It almost brought tears to his eyes. All he could do was draw breath in sharp little gasps as her gray eyes searched his face, divining everything he felt. He'd never been so naked before. "We're going to spend the night together," she said. "Do you understand that?"
"Of course I do."
"Do you now? Well, I'll tell you anyway. It means that we can make love for as long as our bodies can last, that there will be nothing else to consider, no timetable, no having to go home, no caution about someone coming in, just you and me alone, with as much joy as we can create. And then when we're done with each other, we're going to fall asleep in each other's arms. We've never known that before, Lawrence. And it's going to be the most exquisite moment of all for me, because I'll do it knowing I'm going to wake up with you beside me. You don't know how long I've wanted that to be." Even in the dusky light, he could see the admiration on her face and the hope. "I want that just as much as you do," he said. "I wish you'd said something before. We could have worked out a way to make it happen before now."
"Would you have done that for me?"
"Yes."
"I love you, Lawrence."
Her expression became rueful. "And you know all of me now, everything I am, however foolish that is."
She swung her legs around and straddled him just above his hips. "You're not foolish," he told her earnestly. The grin that dawned on her mouth was wicked and knowing. Fingers slid back up his chest. "You're so fit now," she said huskily. "It's indecent. You're the one who wanted me in this condition." "I did, and I'm a grateful girl." She arched her back, then slowly, tauntingly, began to undo the lace bows running down the front of her negligee. They missed their first scheduled skiing lesson, staying in their room together for over a day. Not that it particularly mattered. Amethai wasn't going to move into Nyasana's penumbra for another 60 hours. It would remain light for all of that time. And when they finally did get out of bed to have breakfast, Lawrence called the school and arranged another lesson. The AS receptionist told them another slot wasn't available for 5 hours. They took a walk through the town, looking at the restaurants and cafes and bars. Pavements were slatted aluminum walkways set up between the buildings, standing on the same kind of legs. Lawrence loved it. The first open-air town he'd ever been in. The sensation of freedom was invigorating. Temperature was at least 15 to 20 degrees below freezing. Not that he cared about that. They both wore their brand new ski suits, colorful one-piece garments with a lacework of active thermal strips whose conductivity could be set by an integral thermostat, allowing you to choose whatever temperature you wanted to be at. The hoods were close-fitting and had extra flaps, which could be pulled across the face. They were essential to stop windburn when you were skiing, but in town most people let them hang free. "It's like you can feel the ice pulling heat from your skin," Lawrence exclaimed. He was leaning over a walkway's rail, looking down what passed for Orchie's main street. Buses and ice bikes roared about, carrying vacationers between the hotels and the runs. "Nice to know," Rosalind said. Every flap on her hood was closed tight, leaving just her goggles poking through. Even so, she stood slightly hunched, as if fighting the cold. Lawrence laughed and kept walking. They stopped off in a couple of stores. The only difference they could find between them were the names of the owners. Both were franchises to the company that ran Orchie, and both of them sold the same ski equipment. There weren't many manufacturers on Amethai yet. "Business opportunity," Rosalind observed. She giggled at Lawrence, who was trying on a different hood. Its style was awful, all pink and orange stripes. "Two business opportunities," she corrected. "I want to be seen on the slopes," he said with pained dignity. "What as?" They moved on. The trouble with a town made out of identical modules, they decided, was that you didn't know what kind of businesses they contained until you were inside. The names flashing over the doors didn't offer much of a clue. Accessing the data pool for a local directory was a pain and too functional. They just wanted to stroll and take in the sights. Orchie wasn't really built for that. There was no civic identity. Its purpose was simply to house and feed people in between skiing jaunts. They did find a reasonable cafe eventually. The Flood Heights was positioned as close to the edge of the rift as safety would allow. So Lawrence and Rosalind sat at one of the window tables and ordered hot chocolate and a plate of Danish pastries. He sat sipping at his mug, looking up into the sky with a kind of wistful admiration. He'd never seen Nyasana like this, not with his own eyes. Here on the near side, it hung directly overhead, a massive circle sliced by 1,000 compacted cloud bands. Clearly defined lines of rust-red and grubby white, grating and tearing at each other with hooked curlicues. Hundreds of runaway cyclone storms the size of moonlets were constantly on the prowl amid the upper layers. They distorted the neat arrangement of bands, chaos engines churning the usual colors into freakish shades with oceanic-sized upwells of weird chemicals from the unseen depths. Sheets of electricity surged outward from their eyes, too vast to be called mere lightning bolts. Continents of electrons birthed and extinguished in microseconds. Their ephemeral illumination ensured that Nyasana's night side was never dark. A jade aural phosphorescence writhed permanently within the cage of the ionosphere. while the discharges themselves fluoresced ragged patches of cloud thousands of kilometers across.
"They're going so fast," Rosalind said, gazing down at the skier sliding along the snow.
"Do you think we'll learn to go that fast this time?"
"Huh?"
Lawrence brought his attention back to the ground, looking where she was. "Wrong question. You've got strips of polished composite strapped to your feet, and you're standing at the top of a mountain of ice. The trick is learning to go down slowly." She stopped dropping sugar lumps into her chocolate and flicked one at him. "Pratt, you know what I mean."
"Yeah, I don't suppose it's that difficult, not on the nursery slopes. They claim you can get up to moderate grade by the end of a week."
"It looks scary, but I think I'm going to like it."
She watched several skiers as they reached the bottom of the main slope, curving to a halt in a graceful spray of snow. The cable lift began tugging them up to the top again. On the other side of the rift, slim-line fissures extended deep into the ice cliff, intersecting each other and twisting around in convoluted geometries. Sunlight shone into them to be refracted in glorious iridescent rainbows, forever encased below the translucent surface. Rosalind sighed contentedly.
"I'm so happy. I've got you, I've got a life. It's funny, I never thought leaving Earth would allow me to be happy. You know the only thing I miss?"
"What's that?"
"Boats."
She gestured around extravagantly.
"I mean, Amethyst's leisure industry is starting to lift off. There's this and all those hotel domes in the middle of nowhere, and that ridiculous five-city motor rally race they've got planned for next year. But there are no boats."
"Give it time. Our oceans are filling up, and there are lakes forming on the continents."
"Huh. It'll take another 1,000 years to melt this glacier. So I'll see none of that till I'm either dead or too old to care."
"Such a shame. It would have been nice to stand on the prow with the sails creaking away and feeling the wind on my face." "When did you ever do that?"
"Dublin has a port, I'll thank you, although it's mainly for the big cargo ships that come in from England and Europe. But there are sailing clubs along the coast. I know how to crew a dinghy. I was even getting quite good at windsurfing."
Her gray eyes stared off beyond the horizon.
"But I've done it once. Better that than never."
Lawrence slouched down in his seat. "And I never will."
"You poor old boy," she pouted. "I fell off a lot. The water was freezing and didn't taste so good either. Heaven alone knows what pollution was in that sea. That's the thing with memories. You only ever dwell on the good parts."
The lesson went the way of all first skiing lessons. Lawrence and Rosalind spent a lot of time slipping about and falling over. But they did make a kind of progress, enough to slide down the nursery slope several times without landing in a tumble of limbs and poles, enough to get an idea of how much thrill there would be from descending the main slope, enough to promise faithfully they'd be back on time tomorrow. It wasn't until they got back to the hotel room that their muscles began to protest at the way they'd been abused. Ankles and calves ached as they stiffened up. Lawrence's shoulders throbbed as if they'd been bruised, which he could only put down to the way he'd pushed himself along with the poles. With laughter tinged by winces, they stripped off and got into the bath together. Soaping each other down was an erotic foreplay that quickly evolved into full sex, sending water all over the floor. Drying each other in the big soft towels had the same effect. Then they moved out into the main room where the bed waited invitingly. After their third bout of lovemaking, they ordered a huge room service dinner, complete with iced champagne. The mattress was too unstable for them to eat in bed, so they sat in front of the veranda window wearing big toweling robes and tucked in.
"Those slopes are going to look beautiful after sunset," Rosalind said.
The instructor had told them that when Amethyst moved into the Umbra, the runs were all illuminated by orange and green lamps. Skiers themselves wore red and white torches on their helmets. It was as if the whole valley side was invaded by swarms of dancing starlight. Lawrence took her hand and gave it a squeeze.
"We'll see it.
Our last days here are in the conjunction night." We'll be good enough to be using the main slopes ourselves by then. They say that when we're in the heart of the Umbra, Nisana is like a flaming halo, as if the sun's set the edge of the atmosphere on fire.
I can't wait.
They took the half-empty bottle of champagne and a box of chocolates back to the bed. Lawrence lay on the mattress, a flute of champagne in one hand, the box of chocolates in reach of the other, and Rosalind curled up beside him. She squirmed around for a moment until she was perfectly comfortable, then said,
"Go on, then."
"Thanks." He kissed her brow and told the room AS, "Access my personal file, entertainment section, and play Flight Horizon, Series 6, Episode 5. Give me the standard third-person view edit."
"Happy now?" Rosalind asked.
She always watched Flight Horizon with him, though he was pretty sure she was humoring him rather than developing any deep interest in the crew of the Ultima.
"I am, thank you," he said with dignity.
She snuggled in a fraction closer and took a sip from her own flute as the credits rolled and the signature tune began its fanfare. 80 minutes later, the Ultima had managed to prevent a planetary collision that would have wiped out 3 sentient alien species. One of the species was furious with this interference in their glorious destiny as angels of the apocalypse and came gunning for the starship with some very nasty weapons. 3 of the crew had been killed before the end, 2 of whom had just got engaged.
7 crew in 3 episodes, Lawrence said in dismay. That's as many as in the whole of Series 4.
Oh, dear. Rosalind's lips were pressed together to hold back her giggles. She attempted to put on a grave expression.
That's not good, then?
It doesn't help their chances, no.
Oh, poor baby.
She wriggled around until she was on top of him and gave him a wet kiss while she giggled. Lawrence played stubborn. Rosalind laughed outright.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just that you take it so seriously.
I used to take it very seriously. They were good role models when I was younger. It meant a lot to me then. Now it's like having old friends around. I can appreciate it without adulating it. You showed me there's more to life than the eyes. But I still claim it's a pretty good show.
Oh, Lawrence. She turned back to give the big sheet screen a remorseful look. That was nasty of me. I sometimes forget how different our backgrounds are.
Hey, he stroked her back gently. You couldn't be nasty if you tried.
Except to Alan.
Lawrence sniggered. That wasn't nasty. That was funny.
True.
She lay down beside him, their faces a couple of centimeters apart.
You were right. Flight Horizon isn't a bad influence for a growing boy.
Well, I'm growing out of it now. Damn, taking an administration class at university. That's about as far away as possible from what I used to want.
No, it's not. Command qualities are the same, no matter what fancy name you stick on them. And it will be a damn good basic if you ever change your mind and go in for officer training.
Ha! Training for what? Dad said it. We just run a passenger service. You should know. You've been on it.
I wanted to be a part of exploring the galaxy, pushing back the frontiers.
That's all over now.
Rosalind propped herself up on an elbow to look at him. This is what I can never understand about you, Lawrence. You always tell me how much you hate MacArthur for shutting down its exploration program. Yet you never talk about anything else but staying here and making your contribution to Amethi, to the company. That's dichotomous to the point of schizoid, especially for you.
What the hell are you talking about?
If you can't do what you want here, then leave and do it somewhere else.
There is nowhere else, he said in exasperation. Her perplexed look was equally impatient.
Well, not apart from Earth with its half-dozen exploration fleets, no.
Despite the warmth of the room and her body, the lazy fizzing of the champagne in his blood, Lawrence was abruptly cold and terribly alert. What she'd said simply wasn't true, because it contradicted his whole world, everything he'd known and done since that hot-tempered day when he'd ruined the fatworms.
What did you say?
That you should go to Earth and sign on with another company if you feel so strongly about all this.
His hands closed about her upper arms, squeezing hard.
What other fucking companies?
Lawrence?
She looked from his hands up to his face. Sorry. He let go, tried to haul in his temper. It seemed to be as intense as his fright.
What companies? Are you telling me that someone is still running Explorer fleets?
Of course they are. Xantiu Braun is the biggest space-active company of all. But Alphastan, Richards Montana, Quatomo, are all still funding missions. None of the fleets are as big as they used to be before everyone started their asset realization atrocities, but they still send out starships to survey fresh stars. And Xantiu Braun has its portal colonies as well.
Somebody's still funding colonies? His voice had dropped to an aghast whisper.
Yes. Lawrence, didn't you know any of this?
No.
Shit.
She was giving him a very troubled look. Lawrence, I want a full data pool trawl, he told the room AS in a flat voice. Get an ask ping to pull all the information you can on current interstellar exploration, specifically the activities of the Alphastan, Richards Montana, Quatomo, and Xantiu Braun companies.
There are no files on current interstellar exploration, the AS reported. All information pertaining to current human starflight activities concern commercial flights and asset realization missions.
Lawrence emitted a punch-drunk snort, astonishment momentarily overcoming his anger.
He lied to me. He fucking lied. My father lied to me. That bastard.
Lawrence? Rosalind reached out tentatively, her hand touching his shoulder.
This whole world is a lie. Everything I'm doing is a lie. Nothing is true.
He jumped off the bed as if it had burned him, standing with every muscle tense.
I could be doing it right now. I could be on Earth at an officer academy. And what am I doing? I'm taking fucking administration. That's what I'm fucking doing. And I was so pleased about qualifying, I celebrated. Celebrated. Sweet fate.
His fists rose up, searching for something to strike, something to punish. The rage felt superb, making everything so clear.
Lawrence, calm down.
Why? He shouted. I've been calm for 4 years, which is what he wanted. That piece of shit. That's what MacArthur's rigged this whole world to be. Nice, quiet, obedient little drones doing as they're told to boost share prices.
Lawrence, please.
Rosalind was close to tears. Stop it. The hurt in her voice tripped every defensive reflex he had. Rosalind should never be upset. That was his reason for being alive.
Okay. He held his hands up, a conciliatory gesture. Okay. You're right. This isn't you. You're not to blame.
He hunted around the room, not knowing what he was looking for. Nothing here, that was for sure.
We're leaving. Get your stuff together.
Lawrence, we can't leave.
I have to.
He lowered his voice, almost pleading.
Rosalind, he lied to me. He lied so big he warped the whole world around me. He trashed everything I wanted, everything I was. Can you understand that?
She nodded slowly.
What are you going to do?
Ask him? No, make him. Tell me the truth. I want to know if Amathai University degrees qualify me for another company's Starship Officer Academy. I want to know how to get there. I want to know how much it costs. I want to know.
They caught a taxi from Templeton Airport. Lawrence told it to drop Rosalind at her dome first, then take him to the Newton Estate.
It was afternoon Templeton time when he finally got home, and he'd been traveling for nearly 20 hours. Changing his flights around had been relatively easy. The airline was used to people leaving Orchy early with injuries that had put an end to their skiing, and passenger manifests were drawn up to accommodate last-minute additions. Full-spectrum lights were shining above him as he walked into the estate's main temperate dome, filling the vast enclosure with a harsh glare. The sun had fallen below Templeton's horizon days ago as Amathai's orbit carried it toward inferior conjunction. Somehow the artificial lighting always seemed wrong to him, as if the engineers were using the spectrum of a different star altogether. Faint, multiple shadows
fanned out around him as he walked along the stone path. The red and gold climbing roses that swarmed up the pillars on either side were beginning to fade, shedding their petals across the ground. As he walked along, he heard the shouts and whoops of his siblings playing in one of the sunken lawns, so he made a right-angle turn at the end of the rose walk, taking a longer route to the house. Making sure he avoided them, he didn't want anyone to know he was back. It was strange, but he still felt protective toward his siblings. They were too young to know what kind of person their father really was. That childhood innocence should be preserved. It was too precious for him to ruin in the flare of temper and reckoning. When he got to the landing, he heard the soft murmur of voices coming from the study. He knew his father would be in there at this time, although it was unusual for someone else to be with him. The door was partially open. Lawrence edged closer, careful not to make a sound. His father was one of the people in the room. He knew that cheerfully confident voice anywhere. The other was female. He thought it was Miranda, the latest junior nanny, another awesome beauty in her early 20s. "Not even make it to the ski slopes," his father was saying in amusement. "The two of them away together for a week. Hell, he'll come back screwed senseless. I'll probably need to send an ambulance helicopter for him." Miranda giggled.
"That's what you wanted, you said."
"Yeah, I know. Damn, she's good at her job. Cheap at the price. And those legs of hers, have you seen them?"
"Job."
The word echoed silently around Lawrence's brain.
"Job?" "Yes, I've seen," Miranda said. "Why, you like?"
"Oh, yeah, I definitely like. I'm tempted to pay for a month with her myself afterward."
"What, his girlfriend? That's really kinky, Doug. Besides, my tits are much bigger than hers. You said you like that. You always say you like that."
"So, I'd have the two of you together. That way I get the best of everything."
"Together?"
"Yeah, I love a good dirty threesome. It'd be quite something, watching you and her going to work on each other."
"You know, I think I'll enjoy that. Rosalind always looks so sweet. It would be fun to fuck her. I bet she'd be really hot if you press all the right buttons."
Without the name, Lawrence could have forced himself to believe they were talking about someone else, that this was some ludicrous, appalling coincidence. Two other people going on a skiing trip. A different girl his father fancied. Someone else, not them, not him, not Rosalind. Lawrence's trembling fingers pushed at the heavy wood door. His father was sitting behind the desk, with Miranda perched in front of him. The front of her dress was unbuttoned, allowing her breasts to spill out. Her right nipple was pierced by a diamond stud. Doug was slowly licking the butt of erect flesh. He looked up in dismay as the door swung back to reveal Lawrence standing there. Miranda gasped and hurriedly pulled her dress together.
"Son?"
It was the first time Lawrence had ever seen his father flustered. The guilt and shock simply didn't belong on that ever-assured face.
"Oh, boy. Listen, what we were saying..."
"Yes?"
Lawrence surprised himself by how calm he was.
"What, Dad? It's not as bad as I think? Is that what you're going to tell me?"
Doug's political control came back with a rueful grin.
"I don't suppose I can, really."
"You bought her."
"It's a little more complicated than that."
"How? How is it complicated? Did you pay for her?"
Lawrence took three fast paces into the room, bringing him up to the desk. "Did you pay for Rosalind to screw me, you piece of shit?"
Doug flinched back from the fury.
"Look, you were losing it, all right? Your school grades were rock bottom. You didn't have any friends. The psychiatrist said you were borderline emotionally retarded, unable to connect with the real world. I was seriously worried. I am your father, however good or bad I am at it."
"So you bought me a whore."
"Son, you had to realize how much Amathai has to offer for someone like you. I couldn't have you throw all that away. And she connected you. Call her what you like. Blame me for the way you met, and I admit it was pretty low. But look at you now. Look what she's done, how much she's straightened you out. You're the top of the class. You play in all the A-teams.
Outside school, you're the one everybody socializes with. She's shown you how much there is to life. I promise you I never lied when I said I was proud of what you've achieved.
Of course you're proud. I became exactly what you wanted.
Why did you ever have me, Dad? Why didn't you just clone yourself?
Son, please. I know this isn't easy. I mean, hell, I never thought you would fall for her quite like this.
Why not? She's hot, remember? What else was I going to do, a loser like me?
Lawrence, you'll get over this. Admittedly, he shrugged reasonably, you'll probably hate me forever, but I can live with that because I know I did the right thing.
No, Dad, you did not do the right thing.
Lawrence turned round and walked out. Lawrence didn't know how he got there. He didn't even know when he got there. But sometime later that day or week or year, he stood outside the door to the O'Keefe's apartment. Even when it finally came into focus and he recognized where he was, he took a long time before he brought his hand up and knocked. It was a gentle rap with his knuckles. Lawrence barely heard it himself. He knocked harder, then harder still. He pounded on the door, seeing it shake in the frame.